The World Health Organization has just declared the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia an international public health emergency. The virus has infected more than 1,700 people, and at least 932 have died since the outbreak began this March in Guinea and then spread to Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria. It's the largest Ebola outbreak ever recorded, and so far efforts to contain it and bring it to a halt haven't been successful. On this week's Please Explain, Dr. W. Ian Lipkin joins us to discuss the Ebola outbreak and how it and other deadly infectious diseases can be contained and brought under control. He is the John Snow Professor of Epidemiology and Director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health and College of Physicians and Surgeons. Welcome to our show, Dr. Lipkin.
Thanks for the invitation.
And we invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Ian, you wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal last Sunday saying that while the Ebola outbreak is serious and frightening, it doesn't pose the same risks of pandemic flu, severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, or Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS. Why not?
Well, I think what I said then is I still hold now. Those diseases that spread via respiratory secretions are far more likely to become universal, to become epidemic, to become pandemic, than this particular infection, which is really restricted to people who have very close contact with respiratory secretions, blood, and so on.
So they're transmitted a lot more easily.
They're transmitted more easily.
Do we have vaccines for any of those diseases?
We have vaccines actually for all of those diseases, although they're not yet approved for human use. Now, with influenza, of course, we have a seasonal vaccine that we use annually, and I encourage everyone to take that vaccine. The challenge, however, with some of these diseases that are not very common is that, one, you have to be concerned about the risk associated with taking a vaccine. It may actually be a higher risk than being exposed to the agent itself, although that's really a modest risk.
Although we've seen that in a couple of cases in a previous illness. I can't remember what it was. I remember people went blind because they were given an experimental vaccine.
There are. These are all issues. But in addition, there's the challenge of getting somebody to make it. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars to take something through testing.
Despite the flu vaccines, it still kills a surprising number of people in this country, not just around the world, but this country every year.
It does. Something like 30,000 people die annually. But those individuals are ones who can't mount a good immune response to a vaccine. Typically, they're people over the age of 60, like you and me, who are at higher risk.
Thanks for revealing that. My audience thought I was 28.
So, you know, these are some of the challenges we have. In fact, there's a lot of work now to try to find ways to augment those vaccines to make them more effective.
Can you explain what made the influenza outbreak in 1918 so deadly? It was called the Spanish flu. Did it originate in Spain?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's probably did not originate in Spain. Just like syphilis is once referred to by the French as the English disease and by the English as the French disease, there is evidence to suggest that it might have arisen here in the United States. Whenever we have a new flu that emerges, if no one has seen it before, then you don't have the ability to make an immune response to it. So it really runs amok. Additionally, there are elements within the virus, its genetic structure, which make it more capable of causing severe disease.
So in the case of Ebola, will people who survive it have immunity for life?
We haven't really tested that yet. I would presume they probably would. I mean, the flu is different because it changes its structure, it changes its coat.
Does that affect the kinds of vaccines we have to create each year?
It does.
We have to guess at what it's going to be like?
So what we do is twice annually, there are groups that meet to discuss what's circulating in the southern hemisphere and then what's circulating in the northern hemisphere. And the opposite hemisphere makes a decision as to what it's going to use in the way of vaccines based upon what's circulating elsewhere.
The Spanish flu...
But just to finish that thought, there's a very strong probability, I would say, now that we're going to be able to get to a universal flu vaccine, which will make it possible for us to not have to vaccinate people annually.
It occurred in 1918 before air travel was common. How did it spread around the world so quickly?
Well, as you remember, 1918 was the was the First World War. So we had a lot of people in very close proximity to one another, easy spread. So we had spread within ships, we had spreads within trenches, and so on. But the other thing that you pointed out, of course, is the significance now of air travel. Here in JFK alone, we have 21 million international passengers annually, and you can get to close to 80 countries on a nonstop flight.
And that's why people are afraid that Ebola may very well wind up coming to the United States.
This is the concern.
Well, how long is the incubation period? How long before somebody boarded a plane would it take before they knew that they might be sick?
Well, the potential incubation period is quite broad. It's something like 2 to 20 days. But most people become symptomatic within 7 to 10 days of infection. But it is conceivable that somebody might have mild symptoms and get onto a plane thinking that they had a mild case of some respiratory virus and then become quite ill on the plane.
Do some people have natural immunities to Ebola or the flu or to SARS or MERS?
There's no evidence of natural immunity to any of these viruses. But as long as you've raised the issue of SARS and MERS, although SARS affected, a few thousand people and MERS has affected even less, the impact of these infections on economies and on travel and trade are absolutely extraordinary.
Could a pandemic on the scale of the Spanish flu occur with them?
With SARS, we had infections in Singapore and in China and in Toronto. And as you may remember, Toronto was actually shut to travel until such time as it was declared, free of concern by the World Health Organization. So this could happen. Now, this is not going to occur with Ebola. So the only places that we're really concerned about it at present, and I want to highlight the fact that we are very concerned because we're losing an enormous amount of life, human life, and it is a tragedy, is in West Africa.
How do you contain it? You can prevent people from countries who might have come in contact with one of these illnesses from coming into your country, but can you really do that in today's world?
No, I think that was really the lesson most recently of SARS in 2003, which led to a greater transparency in talking about what's circulating in the way of viral infections in China. You cannot contain these agents. And in fact, the appearance of Ebola in West Africa is new. Most of the time, we consider it being a problem of Central Africa. Bats, which contain this virus, probably may well have flown across borders. People consume bushmeat carried across borders. There are all kinds of ways in which this can spread.
Well, it was originally thought that it came from bushmeat eating, consuming monkeys and apes, but now bats are the more likely culprits?
Well, no one has actually demonstrated yet that bats are the original reservoir for the virus. So we make distinctions between what we think of as a host that's an intermediate host and one which is a reservoir. By a reservoir, we mean typically, this is an animal in which the virus can live, sometimes without causing much disease at all. And it's only when it spills over into another species that we appreciate how pathogenic it can be.
So the animal that's the host is immune to it?
In some instances, that's the case. There are viruses for which humans are hosts, where there may not be complete immunity, but nonetheless, we're able to sustain it because there are new populations of people who are susceptible all the time.
My guest is Dr. Ian Lipkin, the John Snow Professor of Epidemiology and Director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health and College of Physicians and Surgeons. Today's Please Explain is a look at the various infectious diseases that are now a great concern to us, Ebola just being the most recent one. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Our number here is 212-433-9692 if you want to join in the conversation, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And a listener left this question on our show page, wrote, I'm confused. They keep saying Ebola can't be spread through coughing, just direct contact with fluids. But doesn't coughing spread saliva particles into the air? And if someone were to inhale that, wouldn't that constitute direct contact and fluids?
It's conceivable that this might be present in saliva, but really at very low concentrations. It's really a numbers game. And most people who become infected because they come into contact with secretions directly. So the amount of aerosol that might be associated with a cough is not going to be contagious here. It's going to be very different than what we see with influenza or MERS or SARS. That said, we are exercising precautions in people who are working in very close contact with infected individuals.
Now, MERS and SARS also come from contact with animals. How common is it for infectious diseases to be transmitted from animals to humans?
So the majority of what we call emerging infectious diseases and re-emerging infectious diseases do originate in animals. HIV, AIDS, MERS, SARS, influenza.
MERS comes from camels, doesn't it?
MERS probably comes from camels, or at least our work shows that it comes from camels. But it may also have originally had a bat host. Bats are very Bats are very interesting creatures. They harbor all sorts of things, and so you can. There are a number of animals that are of issue. We've recently, for example, begun looking at rodents, and have found relatives of hepatitis C. So there are many animals that can give rise to these sorts of infections.
Well, bats are flying rodents. So is it rodents that are most likely the carriers? How do scientists track down the origins of a new infectious disease? You keep on saying probably or likely, but you're not saying this is the source.
So with Ebola, until we actually prove that that particular animal has the virus, all we can say is it's likely. The reason we say it's likely is that people have been exposed to bats working in caves, subsequently have come down with a disease that later diagnosed as Ebola. There's a related virus called Marburg, which we do know resides in bats, so we presume the same thing is true in Ebola. And one of the things that I'd been planning to do a couple of months ago until this recent outbreak was to actually join a couple of friends and go out there spelunky and looking for Ebola and its natural reservoir host. So
you want to go spelunking where it might happen?
Well, that's what we do.
Are you going to have to wear a special suit?
That's what we do for fun, going looking for unusual agents. In fact, that's really what my lab focuses on, is identifying new agents.
A listener wonders when an outbreak becomes an epidemic and when it becomes a pandemic.
Well, a pandemic is fairly easy to identify. An outbreak is more than a single individual. An epidemic is a little more difficult. It's somewhere in the middle. But pandemic really means that it goes across the entire world, and it involves people on many different continents. Now, the fact that you call it a pandemic doesn't mean it's a cause of serious disease. All that really tells you is that it's spread around the world.
So we could have a cold pandemic.
We could have a cold pandemic. We could have a herpes pandemic. We get a cytomegalovirus pandemic, but it doesn't necessarily cause severe disease.
How much do the living conditions and access to medical care contribute to outbreaks like this in Guinea, in Liberia, and Sierra Leone?
This is a huge challenge, and I think this is a major factor that we're realizing with respect to all emerging infectious diseases. As we've been seeing, political structures break down, people migrating from one place to another, roads cut through jungles, the ability to rapidly transport something from one area where it may have been isolated to someplace else. In addition, as you displace wild animals, they have to look for new habitats. They come into contact with humans, and they're cheap sources of protein, and therefore you have introduction into the human population.
And then we hear that cultural traditions often can be a problem. People will, the way they bury their dead, or also in some cultures, the belief that spirits might very well, demons might very well have taken over the body rather than just a virus.
Yes, but not to point the finger in one direction only, those people who like to eat rare hamburger meat are more likely to come into contact with E. coli. So that's a cultural thing here, which is a problem. And in China, the fact that people like to have wild animals to consume on a regular basis is what really facilitated the emergence of SARS in 2002.
My guest is Dr. Ian Lipkin of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health and College of Physicians and Surgeons. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we will talk a lot more about these various outbreaks of serious and often deadly diseases. As part of today's Please Explain. Of course, we're talking mostly about Ebola because Ebola is in the news right now, but it could be anything, MERS, SARS, there are probably some other ones out there that we haven't yet even named. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate.